Gone are the days of surface level analytics. Go deeper with Mixpanel. Mixpanel's product analytics let you see where and why users take certain actions in your product so you can build a better user experience. Learn more and get a free demo at mixpanel.com.
Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
So I'm Shiva. I'm a product manager, technical at Amazon Web Services. I went to school at Carnegie Mellon University a couple of years back, and I graduated last year in software management and specialized in product management. And 9 years ago, I finished my master's of 10 years ago, I finished my master's of computer science in National University of Singapore. So that's about me. And this particular topic was coined like a few days back, and the actual topic for the presentation today was transitioning to product management. So I started out my career at Microsoft, so I have to be very watchful of what I say.
Safe space.
Right. So I started my career at Microsoft, then moved into Lucasfilm, the company that made Star Wars, which is acquired by Disney right now. And then I moved to PayPal for 7 years. And then I with Amazon for 7 months. So let's get started. So today I wanted to talk about three topics. One is product innovation. How do you classify how do you know whether you're innovating or not? And second is customer-centered innovation. How am I going to define what is customer-centered innovation? It is one of the most described way of implementing products today, and it's very, very commonly spoken. But how do you know whether you're doing the right thing is what the takeaway is today. And I'm going to talk about a few do's and don'ts. And in the process, I want you to go away today with these three takeaways. We often think, do the customer interview, find out what the customer wants, and so on, all the time in product management. But I'm here to say, see what the customer does and not what they want. The second takeaway is, we often think metrics is an afterthought. We always think about it before the launch and towards the end. Actually, metrics are very important that shapes your product strategy itself. Therefore, once you figure out your target market and your problem statement, you need to think about the metrics. You need to think about success before success happens. So you need to know metrics today so you know where you stand so that you can continuously measure. You don't wait till the end and start measuring. So it's not for optics. Success is just not for optics. It also tells you when you need to pivot, when you need to focus, and when you need to diversify. The last one is MVP. So in product management, we always say we'll build a POC, proof of concept. We'll build an MVP, most viable product, or minimal viable product. I'm going to break that definition and say what a true MVP should be. And this aligns with a lot with what many major companies follow. But I'm going to stress on that. So most of these companies that I view as customer champions, and there are millions more, the problem is a lot of companies think they're customer champions, but practically in 2020, they might not be. Like, we could always say I'm customer focused, but am I truly customer focused? Am I thinking big? Am I observing what the customer really needs? Do I understand the difference between wants and needs, and so on? A lot of the times, some companies, in the name of customer-driven innovation, conduct customer interviews, and then they go ask the customer, what do you want us to do? Right? That's one of the most cliche thing to do. You're not supposed to ask what they want. You're supposed to observe what they do. So I'm going to cover that today of how you do that. So how do you know whether you're innovating? So from my school, I learned that innovation is when you mix two unrelated topics together and you create innovation. And that they said was creativity. In the space of product management, you can't just do that. There are other things into play. So first, in order for you to start building a product portfolio, you need to understand what the customer needs are. These are basic PM stuff. So what your customer needs are, you need to prioritize which is more important. What does the customer really want? And you need to know how the customers will adopt your products. So the three spheres of thought, the first one is desirability. Do they really want this? Do they really need this? The second sphere is viability. Should we do this or should we do that? How are we supposed to implement it? What is the delivery strategy? How do we take this to the customer? Should we do something else to take it to the customer? Or sometimes the biggest solution is to not do anything. And some of us, in the name of building resume, we try to do a lot, but sometimes we just have to do nothing to get things done. And then the third one is feasibility. We are all engineering organizations with a planned budget, and there's limited money in the world, so we cannot do everything. We want to think big, but we'll concise it to what is truly required, and we'll also think about feasibility. So the third sphere is a challenge for a lot of companies, and there are companies which have crossed the chasm, like Apple did with Steve Jobs. Tesla does it with Elon Musk and so on, where they keep pushing the feasibility circle a lot. But a lot of companies try to boggle your creativity down with this for a particular sphere, and the way to, in order for you to say whether something is feasible, is to work with scope. That's what I'm going to cover in the MVP section. How do you play around scope? So when you talk about these three circles, the center part is the most valuable design, which is the intersection of all the three spheres. And in summary, it gives you these three artifacts that you can work with. One is customer needs, priorities, and adoption strategy. So I'm going to use these five words a lot during this presentation. One is vision, which is important for every product manager. You might set the vision for the products. You will set the vision for the organization. You could set the vision for a product portfolio as such. So vision, you got to be fearless in setting the vision for your team or for the product portfolio. By saying that you got to be fearless, I mean you have to be, you don't have to constantly think whether you fit in. So when United States thought of launching a rocket to the moon around 50 years back, I forgot who was the president. Does anybody know who was the president? Kennedy made a presentation where he said, I want to set the vision that the next 10 years is the best 10 years United States will ever have in space missions. And after 1972, we never reached the moon. That vision held good. The United States, the space organizations met the goal, but he delivered what he promised. And it was a vision with nothing about how. It did not say anything about how you're supposed to accomplish it. It was just go to the moon and come back. That's it. It was the role of the organization to come up with the how. Same goes to you. Do not spend so much time on all the hows. Don't think about how to do this, how to do that. And so on. So that was the biggest learning I had by going to management school, where I had to unlearn everything about house. I had to focus on what's and why's. Why should I build this? What should I build? The second one is customers. You need to differentiate between who are customers and who are users. So we often think just about the customers. We might not think about the users. Like, for example, in her work, she might be thinking a lot about the users too. So you have to think about both the customers and the users when you write your product strategy or your vision for the product. Third one, unmet needs. You need to accept that these unmet needs, you might think that you're solving an unmet need. Unmet need is basically a need a customer has and it's not been met yet through a product. And they use conventional or traditional ways of solving the problem. You solving that need is meeting the unmet need. So the fourth one is metrics. I love metrics a lot because I'm very data oriented and I think that's what is truth. Though I'm very enterprising and I can sell my products really well, the nature of most major companies is to be data-driven, where you cannot just say why I'm doing something is the core of a product manager. That's how it gets sold. So for me to substantiate why should I build this product, I need metrics to be in my core. And for that, I need to start working early. And the last one is focus. There are a lot of shiny objects here and there for a product manager to go around. And also your engineering teams might have a lot of shiny objects they'll run around with. And it's almost like shepherding where you have to say, let's walk in this direction. Let's walk in this direction. And you have to do that passively by influence without authority. where you have to constantly say, this is the direction we're supposed to go. In the most passive voice you have, though you want to strangle some people. So this is customer-centered innovation. This is there are so many different companies who have different kinds of customer-centered innovation frameworks. This is one of my favorites, though I can make a few changes here too. So it starts about defining your target customers. You might ask me, do I define the problem statement first or define the customers first? So do I define the market or the customer? So there are two ways of seeing this. One, you identify a set of customers. Maybe you identify children as a customer, and then you figure out what problems they have, right? And when you define customers, you don't have to get to the persona state yet. I hope you guys know what personas are. Are there anybody who does not know who what a persona is? Okay, so you don't get to, when I say define customers, you don't have to get into persona definitions yet. You just think about a group of beachhead market, which you want to target, and then you will probably group of lawyers, group of doctors, children of the age 3 to 5 who go to this kind of a school, and things like that. So you kind of differentiate your customer and see what problems they have. You can either start like that, or you can go from the problem statement. Okay, there is a problem statement that I see that I can never know when the buses in Seattle come at this time. I can start from the problem and then see who are the customers who get impacted. You could do both ways. And then you have to learn how the customers feel about the company. We often think, in the name of product management, we often think just about the customers. We never think about how customers view us. It's called inbound marketing. It's about how customers can feel as the champion of the brand themselves without us doing nothing about it. And I'm going to share how we do that. The next is alignment. A lot of companies, again, for customer-driven innovation, try to keep doing for bias for action. They keep implementing a lot of things just because the customer wants it. And customers are like kids. They'll want everything in life, right? So they'll keep asking for a lot of things, and you keep building things like blobs one over the other, wherein you think that over the time, your technology is not compliant anymore. It cannot scale. So that is one common problem that we always have, that we drag along tech debts in the name of customer-driven innovation, where we keep doing what's right for the customer and not think beyond a certain time span. So that's why I like think big, because you need to think 10 years in advance. Your other kind of managers will be focused on, what do I do in 2020? What do I do in 2021? But as thought leaders, product managers have to think until 2030. Therefore, you'll have to prioritize a few technology projects as well if you're going to solve a problem in 26. They say meet the buck, right? So you need to know where the ball comes to in order to hit. So if you want to plan something in 2026, you need to know how much you're going to scale over time. The next one is map. This is what most of our times as product managers will be spent on, making sure that you tie the problem statement to the customer need, to the solve, to the actually executed product feature. So mapping all these strings together is what many people call roadmap. And if you put a timeline to it and give it to a TPM, it starts execution, right? So most of our time gets into the map. But though this is what is most of our life, we need to focus on other things as well. We need to partner with the organization owners as well, because we need to engage. In order to engage, you don't let other people decide what's and why's. You can, but you need to engage with the leadership and sell it. So first you need to sell your product to yourself. Then you need to sell it to the leadership in order to get sponsorship based on data. And then you have to sell it to the engineers who are going to build it and feel that it's their own product, where you have to be very enterprising. And then you have to convince the customers as well that they want this product. So you have to be engaging with almost everybody and be that glue. Next, transformation. So since you spend a lot of time in creating maps, you do not think about transformation at all. A lot of companies often change their culture in order for them to reflect what they think the perspective of the customer first. What do you think of my company, right? If I'm gonna set a cultural example for my own engineers, what do I set for you, right? In that good spirit, a lot of companies are changing their internal culture as well. That's called organizational behavior. It's a science. So you need to, though you're a product manager and not owner of an organization, unless you're a director, you have to influence without authority the organizational owners as well. What culture do we transform? Do we focus on quality? Do we focus on quantity? What should be the KPI for these engineers? And how do we align it to what the customer truly wants? So you need to have those thoughts as well. Next, measure. So if I would change this, I would put measure here after defining my target customers, because I need to. I always like to define my KPIs before getting into anything. So my KPI before coming here, I didn't come here and think about what success of this speech was. Even before I signed up, I was like, if I have to speak, it has to be at least 5 people in the audience. If it's lesser than that, I'm going to feel bad, right? Same way, you need to think about for the product as well. You don't wait for a particular day and time and decide your metrics. You need to decide your metrics upfront. What defines the success of my product? I'll get into that in a little while. And then last is incorporate, which is about delivering results. You need to incorporate all these thought processes into what you build. So I'm going to have a few, before we get into the takeaways, I'm going to break down what customer-driven innovation truly is. You could call it customer-driven innovation, customer-centered innovation, and so on. The first and foremost is that customers' needs keep changing, which means that what they want or need yesterday is not what they want and need today. A lot of companies try to do something in 2010, and then they go back to the customer in 2012. 2 years is a very long time. Then they come back at 2016, and so on. That's a lot of time. Customer needs to be involved in almost everyday activity, and we'll get to how. So also, we need to differentiate between target customers and secondary customers, right? Target customers are the personas you define as to whom you want to target, and then there are always secondary customers. You might use Uber to go from one place to another. That's your target usage. The secondary usage is you're often checking to see the price, and then you're comparing between apps. That's a secondary usage a company never would have thought of initially. I mean, they would, but that wouldn't have been their target product that they're working on to provide comparative pricing across different products. They wouldn't even have access to other products. So you came up with your own usage of comparing products across two different apps, maybe Lyft and Uber, right? Or Grubhub and DoorDash. Yeah. So that's secondary usage. You came up with your own way of using the product. And then the next one is you have to evaluate your value proposition and benefit almost very frequently, because your benefit to the customer changes over time, changes based on competition and so on. So if your roadmap is like 3 years long and you have charted out what you do over the 3 years, it is actually not worth it. You usually think for 10 years. You think high level items 5 years. You deep dive only for a year max, because things keep changing and you need to be ready for the change. What often happens is people are very emotional with their products. You should be emotional towards your customers, not towards your products. You need to know when to pivot all the time. So if I don't like this tool, I throw it away and go off. I don't keep hugging to say, oh, it's my baby product, I don't want to lose it. So that's one of the problems why most companies fail, is they try to stick on for too long and they become emotional about the product. They have to be emotional about the customer. And the customers also keep changing. So they need to be just need to be passionate about work. So you have to be passionate, but not emotional. Because if you're passionate, you will do the right thing. But if you're emotional, you'll stick to things you're not supposed to. So there are so many different ways of doing it. But the intention of crossing the chasm is to convince more and more people that your product is solving their need. Most of these innovators and early adopters don't even know why they're using the product. The innovators mostly are buying the product because it's cool to have the product. Or they're just very experimental. Or you bought them into the testing phase. Oh, I tested this particular product. Let me try to use it. Oh, you know what? I'm one of the first users to use this product, and so on. Oh, I'm one of the first iPhone users, whatever. So those are people who are very experimental, and those are whom you also test with. But at the same time, these people do not even know what their wants and needs are. And you're trying to pivot your product towards that. So crossing the chasm means that you have to increase your beachhead market size. For example, you could start out with a group of lawyers, and then you go over all professionals, and suddenly you cater to the whole population, right? So I'm going to give you some examples of how they do it. Hello. So crossing the chasm is all about how do I make this more appealing to a larger group of audience, which means that you cannot solve case-by-case basis. You have to be very data-oriented. So in 2020, the way to cross the chasm is to choose any sort of data-oriented approach. It could be machine learning, it could be data analytics to continuously get data, it could be data processing, it could be self-onboarding, which is a new way of dealing with things. You don't worry about customers, customers worry about themselves. So you focus on customers solving their own problems. You don't try to build products to solve the problems. We'll get there. So after early majority, this is called the beachhead market, which is kind of the max you can get to. That's the threshold. And your data should start telling you have to pivot, or you have to diversify, or you have to kill it. So the data keeps telling you stuff, and you have to keep listening to it. So not all the time customers will tell you, I don't want this anymore. You need to listen to the data and find out. So towards the end, there are people who cannot move on, and they still stick to their own BlackBerry phones. So those are the final set of customers, but it's over. You have to move on. So there are a lot of customers, a lot of companies who started somewhere, and then they ended up somewhere else. So these are some examples. 3M was a mining company, literally called Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, and they do something else today, from cellophane tapes to notebooks to Gorilla glues. They do almost everything that you need to craft and build. Then my favorite is Wrigley. So they were a very big supplier of baking powder almost a century back, and their soaps were also very famous. And then one of the cool guys said, I want to start a chewing gum, and then like wanted to experiment, right? Like many of you guys would want to do in your company. And the customers loved it, and he was good enough. He supported his, it is a very nice story to read. And then they pivoted completely from making baking powder to making chewing gums. It was completely different. Nintendo did the maximum pivots possible that I know an example of. Google also did, but they don't believe in pivoting. They believe in diversifying. They have so much money that they'll just keep building more and more. But there are a lot of products that they have decommissioned as well over years. There are products you would not even know existed. That many products they have invented. But Nintendo is very popular going between these switches, and they are completely different. Started with playing cards, they became a taxi company, became a hotel chain, TV network, food company, video gaming. They were just ideating almost every decade, trying to be someone else. And it works, and they're one of the leaders in video gaming now. Nokia was a pulp mill, and then they made good money with phone, as a phone manufacturer, but they didn't pivot after that. Or the owners of Nokia didn't pivot. So that was the reason why it fell. So you got to continuously know when to pivot, when to focus, when to diversify. So some people take the wise decision after they acquire the company, and some people don't. So Amazon started as a bookseller, and it's somewhere else right now. Berkshire Hathaway was a textile manufacturer, and then they do all these three things. Pivoting, focusing, and diversification. You should always think about this in your product space as well. Do I diversify? Do I create more product enhancements? Do I decrease and focus on a few and increase scale? Do I focus on a particular set of customer or a particular set of product solutions? Or do I pivot, throw all this off and start something new? So you need to support this with data all the time. So a lot of people focus on the customer during the ideation phase mostly, and then they don't look at them until they launch. This happens usually in the design phase. So like in design focused companies where they involve the customer to identify what they really want, and then they wait till prototyping for the next interview. Doesn't work like that. So Google's usability labs is more rigorous in testing with the customers, that they do regular customer interviews. And also the interviews are in verbal. They use like Walmart, Google, Williams-Sonoma, House. All these companies give you a problem, and they'll see how you solve the problem. They could just give you a phone and say, tell me what house you want to buy, and they'll see how you do it. They won't ask you, what is the pain points you have in solving this problem? They would never ask you. They always would ask you to do something, and then you go build it. So I'm getting ahead. So there are different layers of product different steps in your product lifecycle. Starts with problem statement crystallization, starts with identifying customers, problem statement crystallization, solutioning, prototyping, pre-launch, post-launch, continuous feature development and so on. And you have to involve the customer in every phase of your product development. The more anecdotes you get out of a customer and the more continuously engaged you are with the customer also feels valued that they were part of the process, as well as you have continuous validation that you're going in the right path. You always have to think about failing fast. And also you have to, one more thing is you have to keep responding to environmental changes as well. When Amazon started AWS in 2006, Microsoft waited till 2012 to start cloud computing. So they said, I'll wait till the person on the other side of the lake finishes it and see if they're successful. And even after being successful, they waited 3 more years and then they started in 2012. Google waited much longer. So you need to constantly know when to pivot, focus and diversify. That becomes a very vital factor in how successful you get. And another one, the new way of treating customers is to let them self onboard. Provide enough information on your website. Focus on human computer interaction. Focus on design thinking. Focus on design heuristics so that the customer knows what to do. You don't have to educate them at all. So you need to focus on design more. Do you know about heuristic evaluation in design? So there you can go ahead and Google today. There are 10 heuristic evaluations of any design on earth. You can even evaluate a door, how it opens and how it closes to any software product. There are 10 heuristic evaluation parameters. You can Google it. So a lot of designers use that to evaluate if they're going in the right path. And they keep doing it every week. They don't do it in the ideation phase and wait till the launch. They keep doing it every day. So you need to provide a way for them to give active feedback. You don't go to the customer, you don't email the customer to say, how did you feel today? Like most airlines do today, right? They send you a mail after you finish the ticketing process and you ask them, how was your ticketing experience? That's 2014, 2013. It's not the case now. You need to constantly have a way of, if customer wants to give a review now, I should be able to. If I want to review Google now, I should be able to. That's how it should be. You should give this is called self-onboarding. The customer knows when to use the product, how to use the product, how to give feedback, and they also have to be valued. So they get this notification back that, you know what, your response is valid, and we want to appreciate that and so on. And with how social media is booming, a lot of companies invest in Twitter messages as well as to appreciating the customers and so on. So inbound marketing is very important in this aspect that we need to focus on inbound marketing, wherein you need to make the field customers as the promoters of the product, which means that you have to acknowledge them a lot. Hey, you did a good job, and so on. This is called gamification. So if you played any of the addictive games, you get a nudge. It does something to your brain, which is constant feedback. The customers love feedback. Like whether it's a vibration, whether it's a tone, whether it's a haptic feedback, whether it's a blob of message that tells you, hey, you did a good job. Customers love feedback as much as you love data as a product manager, right? So you need to focus on the message architecture of how you communicate something to the customer. That makes a huge difference. Message architecture is all about how you position your message across your website, across your product, across your phone, and so on. I can give you a quick example. The maximum, the area of space you use in your phone is how much thumb space you have, which means that most of the time, if an app wants you to say yes, they position it on the right so that you can click yes. It's about that. So you need to really rethink about design as to how the customers truly feel. And that you could do only if you see how the customers solve the problem, not by asking them. And there are other ways. You can have chatbots, which is another way to go today. A lot of insurance companies are going in that direction of having chatbots. And the customer talks almost like they're talking to an insurance agent, to the chatbot, and then they get the premium quotes. And you also have to have an interactive UX all the time, let's say there's a complicated process to fulfill a particular feature. You kind of tell them, this is the step one you do, then step two, step three, and step four. Kind of the initial onboarding process you kind of show on the website and then you don't have to bother the customer. They already know about it. Then the last one is, these things have to be followed whether it's an internal tool or external tool. internal tool, as in if you're building something for inside of inside tools of a company, it still matters because you indirectly serve the external customers by making sure the internal customers are good enough, which means that you have to get ways to get feedback from those tools as well. And the last thing is an architecture that enables you to monitor and facilitate A/B testing. A lot of startups are doing that, but companies that have grown very big and have gotten into complicated architecture are not able to get there. As product managers, we have to be enterprising and storytelling all the time. And that's how you need to keep announcing your progress as well through metrics. The next one is you need to be transparent with your customer at all times, and you have to make them feel valued, which means that you have to rethink your customer service. You need to rethink how, the same thing, the message architecture. You need to see, these customers to know that they are being listened to all the time. And you actively notify the customer about things. Like, how many of you got an update and you never looked into what the actual updates were? Like, do you ever read through all the improvements? You never do. But you still feel acknowledged whenever the iPhone tells you that, hey, these are some security updates. Here are some experience updates. You feel good about it. And therefore, the customers often feel acknowledged whenever they're notified often about changes in the product and how they can participate in the product. I'm not talking about spamming emails saying, hey, you can get 50% Expedia discount. You can get this, you can get that, and so on. It's about telling what are the product changes are. So Apple does this a lot. Whenever they change their terms and conditions, even those things that they don't have to publish, they publish almost everything to the customer saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and so on. Whereby you promote the brand, and then those people who associate themselves to iPhones feel like, oh, this customer, you feel like a stakeholder. You feel like a stockholder, in fact. So you need to constantly think about how do I make customers feel part of the brand? Which brings me to this quote from one of my mentors. A brand is not what you tell the customer. A brand is what the customer tells each other. So you need to think from that perspective as to, if I create this product, how would it come across to a customer? How would it come across to a target customer? How would it come across to a secondary customer? Next, pay attention to feedback not told. A lot of times, people value anecdotes over data. We are human beings, and we value people. We are emotional. So we constantly, and anecdotes is the best way of selling something to the leadership. But you have to pay attention to the feedback not told, which again roots back to the topic that you need to pay attention to metrics. And yeah, you have to do rigorous testing through A/B testing, and you have to adopt piloting, testing different segments of markets in order to validate your product. So having told about all that, let me get into the key takeaways. So Andrew Carnegie, I'm CMU, so I often quote Andrew. So the older I get, the less I listen to what people say, and the more I look at what they do. So this is the principle of user-centered innovation itself, which is what Airbnb follows from day one. They always see how you behave on the website in order to make it better. They never ask you, did you like it, and so on. And even if you give feedback, that's just secondary feedback. The primary feedback is always how you do something. How do you book it? How long you spend on each page? That's what is valuable. So there are three types of products, as I described before. There's new product innovation, there's product feature expansion, and then there are stable products. How do I observe what the customer really needs or wants in each type of these products? In new product innovation, Williams-Sonoma, House, and many other companies did paper prototyping. I'll give a bunch of paper to you and ask you, how are you going to decorate your kitchen? How are you going to decorate your house? And so on. So that's called paper prototyping. You're telling the customer to solve a particular problem with normal things in their life. And then you get there. You make it more digital. The second one is simulation-based testing, which is started by IBM, and then NASA follows it very often. Because a lot of these products are very difficult to build even a prototype. So how do you test even before getting to a prototype? A prototype might cost you $1 billion. You cannot wait till you build $1 billion to test the prototype. So how do you get ahead of the game? So I liked one of the very simple user experience projects that NASA did. So in order for them to assess how old people will use it, they basically made the testers wear a huge suit that was 60 kgs, kilograms, which is around 110 pounds, in order for somebody young to feel how it is to be old. So that's almost like a hardware simulation, right? That nothing software related. So how, it's all about empathy. How do I make sure that how I use a particular prototype now is very similar to how it will be when it is launched for the particular target customer. So I really like that example. And the third one is, a lot of times you build storyboards, you do storytelling, but you just tell it to your leadership and your engineering team to get buy-ins. You never tell it to the customer. Try telling it to the customer, things will change. And they might say, oh, this is just like an ad, it's not even work. Right. So, how many of you have not done storyboarding? Cool. Website called storyboardthat.com, and if you are a creative person, you can create like a cartoon page out of for a storyboard, and it's fun. So, storyboards are the perfect way of sharing my mental model with another person as to what is the problem statement I'm solving, who is the customer I'm targeting, and how is my product solving the problem. And some people build two types of storyboards. How am I solving the problem with a Windows machine? How am I solving the problem with a Mac machine? Just for an example. And I'm a Mac lover. The fourth one is to identify how the customer solves a particular problem statement today. Right? I gave you an example. I would give you something and say, how solve this problem today. How would you find the favorite movie you want to watch on Netflix? I believe that you spend more time on Netflix trying to find what movie you want to watch than actually watch it, right? So Netflix often has the problem statement of solving that problem, and they're working on it. So, which brings me to this artifact that you need to see how the customer solved the problem today using traditional methods. For example, a decade ago, you would see the newspaper to identify what movie you want to watch. You see IMDb website today, or you would see reviews. You'll just Google reviews of a particular movie you heard from a friend, and then you'll just Google. Or you'll just search movies near me, and you have Fandango, or something like that. Fandango, yeah. So you would see that today. So the way the customer solves a particular problem changes on a daily basis. And you have to see if your product is sticking to that fast change as well. And then you need to engage these customers without them knowing what problem you're trying to solve. Because as human beings, we are all inventors. And the customers can really influence you to solve a problem which you actually don't have to solve. And you have to get as much data from them as possible, but you are the expert. A lot of times we think customer is right and we give that crown to them, and then we build products that they don't really need. They all want it, but they don't really need. And then what happens is they find another way of solving the problem in real life, and then they move on, right? So the next one is product feature expansion, which is the typical type of product most of us will work on as a product manager, which is almost 90% of the products, which is just creating, identifying how I build new features for this particular product. Companies like Google, Microsoft, Amazon have all these big companies have usability labs where they do rigorous testing on mockups, on prototypes, on real devices, and so on. So you have to. It's all about pilot testing, A/B testing, and so on. And you, like I previously said, you need a monitoring architecture to observe customer behavior, which is what Netflix does. Netflix knows how many seconds you spend in identifying whether you want to watch Baywatch or not. Netflix almost collects every little bit of data of how you use Netflix. From how long you see a page to identify whether you want to watch the movie or not, how you would prefer one series over the other, how much series do you watch on an average, and so on. They collect almost every information you would possibly use on Netflix. And the last one is stable products. So one of the first product speeches I had was from a Microsoft Outlook product manager. And he was explaining how difficult it is for him to innovate. And he innovates on a very small, and then I asked him, how do you innovate for such a product? And he said that In stable products, you need to give incentives to the customer. So there's something called delighters. There's something called problem solvers, and there's something called delighters, and they're nice to haves. Nice to haves are blingy items you want to solve, but not necessarily that the customer want. And then there's delighters, which is a small activity that you do that goes the longest way. One of the examples that he gave was, there was this particular bakery that was not doing really well, and it started giving out one butter cookie per customer. And that changed everything. That a butter cookie was very less in value compared to the profits they earned in the end. Those are called delighters. Those are ways to attract customers to like something. Example iPhone users is Red, iPhone Red. A lot of people like go behind iPhone Red because of the strong liking towards that color. Once they identified that with Red, they went with iPhone C, which had all those other colors, and so on. And then they call this polarization. You have to like a product and not like a product in order to become a brand. Even if you're an iPhone user, there are some iPhones you would like, and there are iPhones you wouldn't like. If you're into iPhone Max, you're not an iPhone user. If you're an iPhone user, you're not into iPhone Max. So it's, you kind of polarize yourself to like something. And the companies play around with it by providing as much as possible. It's all start. And also, even in stable products, you need to have a monitoring architecture to observe customer behavior. It being a stable product, you are very, very scared to do even the smallest thing. So where do you even start? You start small. You change one little thing at a time, and the customer shouldn't even know that something changed. And it should be a gradual difference over time. The second takeaway I want you to go away with is metrics. And as I previously told, it shouldn't be an afterthought. There are several customer metrics you could think of as a product manager. You could think of footprint, behavior, trends, utility, or if it's a B2B, how much money do I earn from them directly, which it could be savings, could be earnings, could be risk, could be cost benefit based on which part of the organization you're from. Sometimes something a team can say is about savings. They cannot talk much about earnings. So it could be all these different metrics, and each of your organization, I'm sure, would have a key KPI. I mean, it's already key. You will think of a KPI that you're working towards. But you need to think about a lot more metrics than that. As granular as how can I make this little page successful, a little tick mark successful? How do I define if this checkbox is doing its job? Think from that and all the way up there. If you're designing a phone, think about how different parts of the phone are solving the problem. Identify metrics from every one of those angles. And if you do that, you know how successful the product will be. So what kind of, I categorize the metrics into four parts. One is cost benefit. As a provider of this product or the seller of this product, but as you said, the customers not necessarily buy products. Like for example, like you said, internal tools, you don't buy the products. They are still your customers. Probably the organizational owners are the customers, and then all these engineers are the users. So from a cost benefit point of view, what does success mean to you? Is it revenue? Is it the amount of money you earn? Is it customer footprint? How do you classify your own cost benefit? And based on the nature of the company, this differs. The second one is value proposition. There's one called B2C and one is B2B. So value proposition is how is my product truly useful to this particular customer? And then B2B is how do I value this product is useful for the customer's customer, which is like, for example, Netflix customer is my customer's customer, right? So that's cascading value proposition. And then the fourth one is risks. Often we kind of miss the metrics on risks because it's not really attractive. So, but risks is what tells you whether you need to pivot, focus, or diversify. So you need to think about not just the first three defines what success is. The last one defines what a failure is. And a lot of times we are driven by success because it's so good on the paper. It's so good to present to the leadership. But you need to be transparent and show what the risks are. Am I going in the right path? Is the threshold of beachhead market over? And so on. So that you can pivot and diversify or focus. If you don't let yourself focus on the failures, you would definitely become a failure. The third takeaway is often people think the most viable product is often minimal. like a proof of concept. I do not believe in proof of concepts at all. What I believe MVP is, the challenge MVP constantly has is to get those early adopters and innovators in. And they also have needs. They just don't use any product. They also have to be, they are very brand conscious too. Though they want to try new things, they are very choosy too. So how do you attract them with your MVP? I go with the second one, which is the most differentiated product. Solve one problem right better than anybody else, which is what Grab did in Singapore, and they beat Uber, hands down. And Uber is not in Southeast Asia anymore. Grab won all of that by solving only one problem, making sure that the paths to different Uber pool, like it's called Grab Share. The Uber Grab Share is always better than Uber pool. Uber pool takes you all around Singapore before it takes you to the final destination. You feel like you're going on a tour. But GrabShare is the algorithm is much better. They just solve one problem right? So what often people do is they try to build a proof of concept with all loosely hanging things and solving a utility in a half-baked way and think that they can win the market. You, as a product manager, you are trying to pitch your product against big companies. Products that I was consulting for is a company that was trying to identify wait times for restaurants as part of CMU. And they're trying to fight against Yelp, which is a very big company. It would take a few seconds for them to implement something, but that's what we think, but most big companies cannot really build that fast because their focus and the target customers are entirely different. And they actually need some product manager who is not allocated to any product to think about all these. So that's why most companies are thinking about innovation labs and so on right now, in order for them to be quickly adaptable. But you're competing as an early adopter, as a startup, you are trying to compete with stable companies with a lot of money, which means that your differentiated product is not minimal. Just make sure that it solves the one problem right than anybody else. That makes it a good MVP. MVP is not about a proof of concept where you prove your product works. It's about saying it works better than anybody else. Otherwise, it dies. And then the last one is, I understand that MVP is all about quick wins so that you can get more budget for building your product. And that happens in a lot of companies. But you should not think about it as experimentation. It is a quick win, but you're not experimenting. You have to put as much as effort you put for a regular product on an MVP too. Because like parents are, you spend more effort on a baby than an adult, right? So you need to put in that much effort on an MVP too. All that I'm saying because rebranding is very, very expensive. There is no second time to make your first impression, right? Even here, this is the first time you meet me. If I screw up today's presentation one way or the other, I can never fix it unless you spend a lot of time together. Right, and that doesn't work for a company. Once you lose a customer, it's almost lost. That customer will make a brand up for themselves. I used Amazon, I used Apple, I used Microsoft. I always hate that. They kind of make that very biased, judgmental decision as to because every bad experience polarizes the customer the other way. So rebranding is very expensive. That's why I reiterate that. Your MVP should be MDP, which is most differentiated product, has to solve just one problem right than anybody else, and not any half, like not jack of all trades, just king of one or queen of one. So that's my time. So I'll just summarize those three key takeaways. One is always see what the customer does and not ask them what they want. Yeah, through regular feedbacks, you kind of see what they want. Well, you do both, but you choose the data of what they think and do, not what they give. The data that they give as wants is your supplementary data to validate that you went in the right direction. The second one is metrics. Metrics defines your product strategy and should not be an afterthought. It starts when you define your product itself. And these metrics have to be measurable as well. A lot of times, people write metrics, those that are not measurable. Make sure that you build technology such that these metrics are measurable. The third one is MVP is not really minimal. It's not really the viable product. It's actually the most differentiated product in one sense, solving one problem right.
the easiest way to build better products? Get better analytics. With Mixpanel's powerful self-serve analysis, understand what people do in your product to help your teams convert, engage, and retain more users. Learn more and get a free demo at mixpanel.com.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.